Northwestern Medicine, relentless in their pursuit of better health care. Learn more at nm.org/better.
Good morning to you. It's Wendy Snyder here sitting in for Bob Surratt. I don't know what Bob calls this segment, but I call it Wendy's Hypochondriac Corner. And joining us right now, Dr. Jeffrey Bomer, emergency medicine physician and associate chief medical officer. Or director. I don't know. Your title is so long. How does it fit on a business card?
Yeah, it doesn't. That's why I don't have them.
Well, either way, you're at Northwestern Medicine's Central DuPage Hospital. Good morning to you, Dr. Bomer. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
All right. COVID-19 vaccines. I am so mad at myself. I have to schedule one. I'm going to get that and a flu shot. I like to do that before Halloween. But now there's some good news about this vaccine. Not only may it help prevent you getting COVID, but it may help some cancer patients. What?
Yeah, this is a surprising finding at a study that came out of the University of Florida and MD Anderson. They just released this last week, but the study showed that they had over 100 days of these cancer patients, specifically lung cancer patients and melanoma patients. So they're receiving a specific type of treatment called immunotherapy. So it's not the traditional chemotherapy that we usually think of cancer patients getting. They're getting immunotherapy because some of these cancers respond really well to that. So if these patients received the COVID vaccine, specifically the Moderna or the Pfizer, the mRNA vaccine, within 100 days of starting that immunotherapy, they showed substantially increased length of their lives. So in the lung cancer patients, they saw the length of their lives actually doubling. And in the melanoma patients, they don't really have accurate data because so many of those patients were still living at the time that they published the data. So more to come on this, but it's clear that these specific mRNA vaccines are triggering something in the immune systems that's allowing what are called our killer T cells to fight off cancer cells. So not sure what exactly that mechanism is, but I think what we'll see here, assuming that we can get more monies allocated toward mRNA vaccine research, is that we'll be able to sort of target more toward, hopefully with more research, be able to target more toward the cancer treatment. But in the meantime, this is a great indication that these mRNA vaccines may be able to help treat things besides or prevent COVID-19 or other potential infections, but it may actually be used to help our immune system fight off cancer as well.
That is incredible news. It really is.
It really is.
In other medical news, a new study found that the most commonly prescribed antidepressants in the U.S. called SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, tended to have fewer side effects than some of the older medications. Doctor, I'll say flat out, I take Zoloft and I have the craziest dreams. I really do.
Yeah, I've heard that anecdotally from patients as well that have been on it over my course of treating patients, as well as having friends and family that have been on a lot of. As you know, many people are on antidepressants, and so I think what this study was really trying to look at is what are the bad side effects, and how can we lay this out so patients and their clinicians can actually look at what are the profiles of these drugs that are going to really fit the patient better? Because in some cases, so a lot of folks, for instance, can report with certain specific antidepressants that they report a lot of weight gain. So obviously that can be a factor that may steer someone away from that particular medication. But in some folks, their mental health may have led them to a condition where they're malnourished, and the weight gain may be something that they want, actually. So it may help sort of steer the physician or clinician toward the appropriate medication. So I think we've known for a long time that these SSRIs and these SNRIs, serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, have a safer profile in terms of not having as many drug interactions as some of the older ones, which is why they were developed in the first place. Overall, in this study, they did have less side effects than others, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to have side effects. All of these medications, as you know, are going to have some side effects, and they're going to vary from person to person. In your case, it's the vivid dreams, apparently.
I kind of like it, though. It's like, you know, I get this feature film every night. and, you know, I am really a proponent of feeling well mentally. So, you know, if you're battling, I am a very anxious person. So go to a doctor and talk about it. And if one medication doesn't work for you, there are plenty of them out there, right?
That's exactly right. Exactly. And that's what this study shows. They looked at 150 trials over 30 different antidepressants. So there's plenty of different medications out there. So if one doesn't work, there are plenty of other ones that can be used to try to help you with your mental health.
Perfect. Wendy Snyder in for Bob Surratt this week. He'll return next week. Getting back to some medical news, Dr. Jeffrey Bomer, who is emergency medicine physician and associate chief medical officer at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital. All right, doctor, I have found that a lot of people I know, maybe including myself, get a blood test for their yearly physical, and then all of a sudden they come back and their liver enzymes are kind of out of sync. Is it because I drink Diet Coke?
Well, it might be.
Really?
I think this was a surprising, I mean, not surprising, I shouldn't say that. I think there's been some discussions and some limited studies that have been demonstrated that not just the sugary soda drinks, but the diet drinks as well could lead to what we call hepatic steatosis or non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Which is kind of surprising, right? Because there are no calories. Why is this going to happen to my liver? But, you know, that makes sense with the sugary drinks, right? Because it causes these spikes in glucose, spikes in insulin, and then we end up storing that extra energy as fat, one of the places that we store it is in our liver. But when it doesn't have any calories, how does that happen? And so the couple of different theories about why it happens with diet drinks, and by the way, the studies show that just one diet soda a day can lead to this.
Jeez.
It's 60%, you know, I think it was something like 50-60% increase of chance of actually having this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease if in those that do drink Diet Coke, so, or any diet soda, whatever it is. But the two mechanisms that they think are, one, that these diet drinks, because of the sweeteners that are placed in them, actually affect our gut flora. In other words, good bacteria in our intestinal tract. And so that plays havoc on our system in such a way that it interferes with our ability to, you know, whether we can recognize if we're full or not. And so what they think happens with a lot of people is that when you're drinking a diet drink, it actually triggers your mind to want to, you know, sort of crave sweet things. And so a lot of folks will end up later in the day start eating things that, even though they drank the Diet Coke, they're now eating things that are actually causing these spikes in glucose and insulin. So there may be a couple different mechanisms, one with the gut flora altering that, and then secondly, actually sort of creating these cravings for things that are going to cause these spikes in glucose later on. So, so we've known that it's probably not a good thing and that it may not be a healthy drink. And now I think there's studies that show that that is the case.
So, again, probiotics for the win. I mean, it turns out that's so helpful. I know,
drink water instead.
Yeah, water is definitely better for you.
Yeah.
All right, so what is the deal? Everyone's supposed to get 5,000 steps a day, but do you need all that? Do you need more?
Yeah, this has been looked at quite a bit. It's now that we can measure steps and measure our activity, there's been a lot more data being accumulated in terms of what's the right amount. So there's a study that came out recently that was looking at mostly women over the age of 60. I think the average age was 71, but they were looking at, is there a real solid number that's going to tell us that's going to give you that sort of benefit, that health benefit of reducing heart disease and strokes and so forth? And they saw that actually that 10,000 isn't necessary. It actually, it's more about being consistent. So they found that the average number of steps you get through per day and throughout the week is probably more important. They came up with a number of 4,000 actually showed to be the most, have a lot of benefit in terms of being able to prevent heart disease and stroke. So it may not be just, you know, getting that 10,000 steps one day a week and then, you know, being complacent the rest of the week. It's actually that that consistency and getting that 4,000 mark throughout the week is probably more of a benefit. So they even found that if you did 4,000 steps in 2 or 3 days a week, you showed some benefit. So it's not necessarily that you got to get that 10,000 steps every day, but just be consistent. And it doesn't have to be walking. You can do other things, play pickleball. You can go on hikes. You can dance. You know, there's all kinds of things you can do gardening, but it doesn't have to be just walking. But I think just being consistent and just being intentional day in, day out of getting some movement and not being complacent and actually, getting up out of the chair and moving around is the key.
All right. And with you being an emergency medicine physician, are Halloween related injuries going to be happening in the ER?
Yeah, it's a thing. You know, it's having done this for over 20 years, you definitely see some patterns. And I saw this article that came out last week, and they noted that, and it kind of didn't surprise me, but it's not what we usually think about when we think of Halloween injuries. Like most of the time, we're going to think about, kids and being out in the dark and things related to that. But the number one injury that we see are adults getting, cutting themselves when carving the pumpkin. So, you gotta really be careful there. Kids, not so much, but it does happen if they get their hands in the way or if we let an unexperienced child man the knife. I think that we've seen that as well. But it's usually the hand injuries that are the most common. And the number two then would be, actually trip and falling. It's usually related to the costumes at night, the long drapes or capes, and they trip on the mask, inhibiting, their ability to see where they're going can cause these trip and falls. And that's the number two injury we see. And then, thankfully, much lower on the list is our traffic related injuries or kids getting hit by cars. So it was interesting that JAMA did a study 6 years ago, I think it was, that looked at this, and they saw that compared to any other day of the week, that the number of pedestrians being killed by cars doubled on Halloween, and for children between the ages of 4 and 8, it went up by tenfold. So just again, it just reminds us, we got to make sure we're supervising our kids, using flashlights, and making sure we maybe put some reflective tape on our costumes just to make sure that we're being visible and safe.
Thanks for the tips. Happy Halloween to you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Happy Halloween. Of course, anytime.
Dr. Jeffrey Bomer, emergency medicine physician and associate chief medical officer at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital.